Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, June the 26th, 2025. This is episode 3,695 of the Survival Podcast, and it is Thursday, so it's time for an expert counsel Q&A. Show of the week, and we just had Chris Rossini on yesterday, but Chris and Dan McAdams will lead us off today with their segment from the Ron Paul Weekly Liberty Report highlights. Once government gets into war, war becomes everything. Next up, returning, hopefully, regularly to the expert council, Jesse Markowitz. He's going to answer a question today. What is Tor? And why may I want to use it? And I might rant a little bit after that one about the dark web. The dark web. It's in every crime show. I found it on the dark web. There is no dark web. There's just a place. There's just websites that are censored that you can't censor if somebody uses the tools who wants to see them. There is no dark web. There's no. I'll get to it. Matt Sersley will talk about, should he move money into a self-directed IRA in order to buy real estate? Listen to his answer. My answer, I already know, is going to be very similar to his in that the answer is no. But I didn't listen to his full answer yet. I'll listen to it as we make the show together. And there's a but what about. I don't know if he covers that or not. We'll wait and see before I say what I think. Andy McCann will talk about your first steps when you decide, I'm going to get into shape. Especially when you're like 50-something years old and you ain't done jack diddly crap for 20 years. It's hard to take those first steps, and sometimes if you take too big of a first step, then you're like, I don't want to do this anymore, and you stop. And that's a danger and a risk. So Andy will talk about the right first steps and how to mitigate taking that giant first step that makes everything hurt, and you say, I don't want to do this anymore. Kerry Brown will talk about knowing the difference between poison hemlock and wild carrot. And I'm going to put a little bit of reality out there for some posts I've seen about this exact subject, which I'm sure is what made Kerry choose to do it. Specifically on the Book of Faces, there's been a lot of discussion about, is this poison hemlock? Is this poison hemlock? And I've seen a few nervous nilly people because I have children and it's poisonous. And I'll get there too later in the show. Then we have Mike Melito on choosing ammo for your carry weapon. And there's something he does say that I'll reinforce after we hear his segment. And then I've got a segment for you today. The segment appears to be about a new rule for FHA loans, i.e. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, that will allow a person who owns a lot of Bitcoin to declare their Bitcoin if they need a higher net worth in order to qualify for a loan, which when it's FHA, you're talking about a 3% down payment. Okay? You got it, right? That's all. It's what it is. It's not the Bitcoin being collateral for the loan. It's that you can now say, I own X amount of Bitcoin. And there's a whole bunch of Bitcoiners losing their ever-loving shit about how it's a terrible thing because it isn't exactly the way that they want it. And these people are so divorced from anything approaching reality that what I'm telling you is my segment that I'll be doing today isn't really about how this is good for Bitcoin and why it's really good for some Bitcoiners in particular who want to buy a house. No. It's going to be about critical thinking and how when somebody becomes a purist, they just take critical thinking, wad it up in a little ball, cover it with gasoline, set it on fire, and throw it into the woods. Because that's what's going on here. The objections to this are the stupidest, most ill-conceived, not thought out, I've removed my brain and put it in the freezer while I say this objections I have ever seen in my life. By the same people, by the way, who thought it was really great when Strike said you can borrow against your Bitcoin. And what Strike's requiring of the Bitcoin you're borrowing against and what the government's requiring of the Bitcoin you're declaring are night and day with the thing they like requiring a hell of a lot more risk to your Bitcoin than what the government wants. Isn't that interesting? And I am doing this segment today less about Bitcoin and more about how to critically evaluate something when it doesn't fit your particular wants and desires and needs that make you the special little someone you are, like these special little people. It's going to be fun. I think I'm actually going to record it and then put that as a standalone on YouTube for people to share both about Bitcoin and about critical thinking. It'll only be about 10 minutes long, and I will totally eviscerate this absolutely moronic, ill-conceived objection by people who don't know any better because they don't care to find out any better because they love to cling to something I have referred to as willful ignorance. With that, we're ready to dive on into it. I don't have sponsors of the day for you guys today, so we'll just jump on in. I do want to remind you about my book, Laws of Life. If you have not picked up a copy yet, please do. If you have a young person in your life, and I would say like 15 to 35, who could use a little bit of Uncle Jack's foot in the ass toward getting motivated toward life, and specifically the person less that needs the motivation but needs the, like, well, how? Like, they want it, but they can't see it. That's what this book is. This book is the principles by which I built a life that led me to a multi-six-figure career by the time I was in my mid-20s and company ownership by the time I was in my early 30s. It is a principle-based approach to success in life. It will help people with business, but it will help them with life in general. It will help them with their jobs. It will help them with personal relationships. It will help them build themselves into what they can become. Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. Available, of course, at Amazon.com, and we appreciate it when you use TSPAZ when you buy anything online. TSPAZ.com. Go there and you can help us out no matter what you buy as long as you start there first. With that, let's dive on into it. Let's hear from Chris and Dan on the concept that once government gets into a war, war becomes everything.
Trump is criticizing Israel, you know, for once today, and he's even using the F word out there for the media. But, you know, again, we can't trust what he says, even because it's a lot of it's entertainment. And you don't know what's true. So by his actions, he can do stuff to end this. And that's cut money and weapons to Israel, which we shouldn't be doing in the first place, not only to Israel, but to anybody else, too. So we're not going to just single them out. So his actions, then he would prove to us, the American people, that he's serious. And I'm going to say that his presidency is a big loser to all of this, because look at what's happening to his presidency. He was supposed to be keep us out of war. Once you get into war, war becomes everything. Forget about improving America. That is back burner, not even on the back burner. You know, war becomes the focus for everything. The guy only has 3.5 short years left, and he could blow it all on this. Yeah. You know, so his presidency is going down the tubes the longer that this lasts. So do what we've been saying and what Ron Paul has been saying. Cut all foreign aid to everybody. Bring all the troops home and wipe your hands of this. But, you know, it's easier said than done. He's got pressures to do it, but that is the American position. If you care about our country, do these things. Somebody has to do them. You're the guy that should be able to do them. You came in on a wave of populism unlike anything before. Do it. Get us out of this mess. Instead, they started it, and now he's trapped.
You're absolutely right, Chris. The one thing he could do was disengage, and people are starting to see it. The other thing, Chris, that's important, and, you know, you cover economics and finance closely with Dr. Paul, but, you know, this little episode, this little war, not just the bombing at, the bombing on Sunday, which was significant. You can imagine 120-some aircraft, how many B-2 bombers, how much ordnance, how much refueling. This had to have cost multiple billions of dollars to, as you say, bomb an empty desert. But not only that, but all of our backstopping of Israel throughout this crisis. Imagine how many billions of dollars that has been. This is coming back, as you know, Chris, better than anyone, back to the American taxpayer in the form of inflation. We are all going to pay for the fact that Netanyahu tried to wrong foot the United States, tried to wrong foot Trump and launch an attack on Iran. We have to pick up the bill. Americans need to start getting sick of this and asking questions about it.
So here's my take on this. Again, usually when it comes, especially Chris and Dan together, it's not that I disagree with the conclusion, it's that I disagree with the argument as it is structured. So I absolutely agree with the main takeaway being how terrible it is for any government to get into any war that can be avoided for two reasons. One, because war is death and destruction, and it should be a somber, well thought out, pragmatic thing if it happens at all, because human lives are precious on all sides. That's the ethical argument. But they're right when they say the problem is once you envelop in yourself into war, then war becomes everything, and all the things you should be doing for your country as someone governing, you cannot do. It becomes all-encompassing. I agree with that. But here's where my problem with this whole thing has been from the libertarian side for like the past 3 or 4 weeks that led up to this and now the other side of it. And they're still doing it. And it is that the argument was from the standpoint of the United States does not need to get into another long, protracted, drug-out war on the ground in the Middle East. And the people that made that argument had full support of it until it became very clear that that was never what was going to happen. And I actually listened to Dan and Ron lament this on an episode yesterday, that when people found out, well, when they changed the question to simply eliminating Iran's nuclear capability and flying away, that the whole public turned around and flipped. So there was massive objection in the, not libertarians, right? Not even like real small government conservatives, not even alternative mindset people, whatever, right? True anti-war liberals, like not just that, like the general population. The right down the middle, mom and pops, were totally opposed to this action until they found out what it was. Do you know part of why that is? Because the entire argument was flawed to begin with. The argument should have been the United States should not be interfering in a war between Iran and Israel. It is not our place, and we have no right to bomb facilities in Iran, full stop. But no. We can't do that, right? We can't do that. We have to always invoke this giant argument of we can't be in a protracted long ground war in where we're never going to. We're never going to. Let me say it again. We were never going to. Chris so much has admitted that yesterday that I called that out before. And this, the danger in this is that when we do this, right, when I say we, I mean people on this side of the issue do this, we expand the argument beyond the scope of the argument, we always end up with egg on our face. And Trump looks better now than he did a week ago. Right? Trump, maybe this was a bad action, but the bad action in comparison to how we sold the argument against it as a community actually looks really good now. In other words, we look bad and Orange Man look good because we didn't make a principle-based argument. We made a theoretical argument over a theory that was never in play. We started talking about World War III. My grandson asked me about this a week ago. I said, this is stupid talk. The Texas National Guard could take out the entire Iranian military. Especially if, like, above ground force, you know, not land invasion. Like, we're not going to have World War III over frickin' Iran. This is dumb. We talked about sending your sons off to war. Nobody sends their sons off to war. Will you stop saying this? People join the military, or if we reinstate the draft, people are drafted into the military. When a politician signs their kids up for war, they don't, and neither do you. Stop saying stupid things. Stop saying things that aren't going to happen. Stop arguing from the point of the highly unlikely, right? And argue from the point of the highly likely or absolutely going to happen. Argue from a point of reality on the merits of the argument. Don't be like the Democrats. How are they being like the Democrats? First of all, I love both of these guys, but they're still doing it. They're still talking about a long, protracted, drawn-out war after the bombing. It's not happening. We all know that now. Still talk about it like it is. How's that like the Democrats? You have the Democrats saying, this is unconstitutional. Trump can't do this, blah, 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 blah. He needs to come to Congress first. No, he doesn't. According to the laws you made and the Constitution of the United States, guys, no, he doesn't. Now, Roe something Connor or whatever the hell his name is has a bill proposed to actually place more limits on the president's power to do this, which if they existed, that bill would not be proposed. And the Democrats are really not interested in passing it. Neither are the Republicans. They're not going to pass it. right? And the only reason he's submitting it because he has clear ground to do it because he knows it's not going to go anywhere because he doesn't really want to do it anyway because when their guy gets in next time, they want to be able to do it again because they were okay when Obama dropped bombs all over the fucking place without telling them first, without no authorization. So the Democrats look dumb. I've said this over and over. If you want to make Trump's worst action or statement look good, just let a Democrat talk about it and Trump looks great. We shouldn't be helping. We shouldn't be helping with that. If the man does something wrong, if he says something wrong, and God knows he does at times, we should be criticizing the actual thing, not our extrapolated fantasy that comes out of it. I'm sorry. And that's what's been done. And that's why this argument now makes everybody making it look dumb. Even if they're the smartest people in the world, they still look dumb because they argued from a bad point of reference. Of course nobody wants another long protracted war in the Middle East. Of course nobody wants troops going in on the ground. Of course nobody wants that. And of course we can't trust government just because they say they won't not to. But if we look at the totality of everything Trump did for the 4 years that he was in office, everything he did leading up to this, every way that he's handled every situation, to believe that it was anything otherwise, well, that was dumb. Now, what Chris said yesterday, and I agree, but this could cascade. Then you should have made that argument, but you didn't. See, that's the problem. All the special libertarians did not make that argument. Yes, this is all that it is planned to be. But after it's done, Iran could do these 8 things. I covered that recently, didn't I? And if they did these things, here would be the potential fallout. We don't know where it would go. It could lead to further entanglement, and therefore we shouldn't touch it. By the way, they have a right to build whatever they want, even if you don't think they should have it, just like every other sovereign nation does. And then you would have to argue that the merits is Iran with a nuclear weapon a threat to world safety. And we can have that debate, except we're not going to because we're never going to get there because we've argued the entire thing incorrectly from the beginning. This is what I think, but what do I know? Let's hear about Tor and why you might want to use it in the dun-dun-dun, the evil dark web. You better stay away from it. It's going to get you.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today's question comes from Janet. Janet asks, what is Tor and why might I want to use it? I'm interested in privacy and heard about the dark web and Tor, but I'm not really sure where to get started. Let's start with what is Tor. Tor is short for the Onion Router. It's an open source network designed to allow for anonymous communication online. It's called an Onion Router because the data that gets transmitted is encrypted through multiple layers and routed through servers around the world. Each server removes a layer of encryption, making it much more difficult to trace the overall connection. The name Onion comes from this layered encryption process. There are 3 main reasons why people would choose to use Tor to access websites. The first is for privacy and anonymity. By using Tor, it can help conceal your identity and online activity from other folks who can see your internet traffic. For example, when you access the internet from home, your internet service provider at home can see what websites you go to. If you access the internet from the Wi-Fi at the coffee shop's Wi-Fi can see what websites you're going to. The second is to get around censorship. It may be that your country, your internet service provider, or the coffee shop may not allow you to browse to particular websites. Since Tor is worldwide, the address that you appear to be connecting to and coming from might be anywhere in the world, not just your home country. By using Tor, they only know that you're using Tor. They don't know your final destination. Now, some internet providers and some website hosting sites block Tor because of the potential for abuse by anonymous visitors. This is not a panacea that magically works around everything all the time. The third is to access websites hosted as hidden services. These are the ones that use .onion addresses and are reachable only through the Tor network. Just as you may want to access a website anonymously, sometimes people might want to host a website anonymously. By hosting it with a .onion address as a hidden service, the only way to get to it is through Tor, and therefore it gives the website provider additional privacy as well. Sometimes these hidden services are referred to as the dark net. Some of these services may have content that is dangerous, fraudulent, or immoral. Some may be illegal in the country where you reside. They may be inappropriate for some or even most people. With the additional anonymity, there is increased risk for misinformation, scams, and other malicious activity that could occur there. Having said that, many onion services are hosted specifically to allow for increased anonymity and protection of the people hosting and the people visiting the site. Whistleblowers, journalists, activists, they may all be interested in protecting their identity and communications while pursuing perfectly valid pursuits. One frequent usage for hidden services is for individuals running services or websites from home, not through a commercial internet service provider. The configuration offered by most ISPs includes having a dynamic IP address, making it harder to connect a regular domain name, myservice.com, whatever it might be, to that home-based server. Even if someone works around that, they still have the potential issue that the terms of service may not allow this. Hosting a hidden service can be easier technically and may avoid notice by the ISP. A quick aside, this is exactly how the current Start9 servers make it easy for you to host your own service, let you access it from anywhere in the world without having to do any complex networking work. The only challenge is, in order to access it, you do need to use the Tor browser. Signing up with a commercial VPN provider can hide what websites you access from your local ISP and hide your home information from the websites you visit. But all of that information still exists and is available to the VPN company. Most privacy-focused VPN providers will talk about how they do not keep logs and do not share that personal information, but you are trusting them. With Tor, your connection enters through a Tor entry node that only knows about where you're coming from and has no information about your final destination. It is then routed through the Onion network and leaves from an exit node to the website you are visiting. And that website can only see information about the exit node and has no information deeper into the network. For most people, most of the time, this is definitely a vast improvement over the regular default browsing. But it is not foolproof. The biggest concern is the risk of collusion between the multiple servers that might work together to track you. So, if you want to use Tor and browse these hidden services, browse the web anonymously, what do you need to do? The easiest way to access this is just download the Tor browser. Go to the website torproject.org, and right on the homepage, there's a link to download the browser. They have downloads for Windows, Mac, Linux, and Android. Once you've downloaded the software, you can run it, and when it starts up, the first thing it will do is to create a Tor circuit, the set of servers that it will use to onion route your internet traffic. That's all it takes to get up and going. You should be aware that because Tor is adding an additional routing layer and encryption layer on top of all of your traffic, the performance does tend to be slower and can be less reliable at times. It is also possible to install Tor as a service where it runs like a VPN, and then all of your internet traffic can traverse Tor instead of being open to your primary ISP. If you have an iPhone, there's an iOS app called Orbot that allows you to set up a Tor connection that is implemented as a VPN. This allows you to use your built-in Safari browser over the Tor network to visit those hidden services, the .onion sites. When using Tor, be aware that if you do this from a device that someone else has control of, work, school, parent, they may still be able to see what you're doing and may have questions as to why you're logging into something that appears to be in some strange foreign part of the world. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. If you have expert counsel questions for me, please get them into Jack. I know it's been a while, but I hope to get more coming in soon.
Let me explain why I despise the term the dark web. Personally, it starts out with everything Jesse just said. I don't need to rehash. It's basically a way to host information, sites, and services online that are unsensible. That's it, uncensorable. That's it. That's what it is. That's when they say the dark web. That's what they mean. But do you know what they're actually doing when they put it in every crime drop? Oh, don't you go there. Oh, you don't know what will happen. Once you're there, well, ha, ha, ha. You'll get there. It'll look like Google. But there'll be the Grim Reaper over the search bar. And whenever you click on anything, you're going to get your information stolen. And they're going to come kidnap your children and steal your dog. That's the impression they're giving on purpose, because they don't want you to know that this capability is available for you to use for hundreds, if not thousands, of legitimate services. Oh, and it could be risky. You don't know. Okay, so yesterday I looked at some of the stupid short videos on Facebook. I mean, I'm sorry, when you show me a pit bull dressed like a clown, I might look at it. I think it's cute. And so I scroll to the next video, and it's another video that's kind of goofy, so I skip and I get to the next video. It's an advertisement. It's an advertisement for White Oak Pastures. They have ribeyes on sale for 99 cents a pound. What? I'm buying limit one unit. What is it? One steak? What how was it? So I click on it, and you can buy 10 pounds of them as one unit. And there's New York strip for 89 cents a pound. And there's big, thick, giant, gorgeous chuck roast, and it looks just like the White Oak Pastures website. But I look at the domain name, and I go, something's hinky here. So I check the URL, and it's owned by some jackass in, Pakistan or something. It ain't Pakistan. It's, like, Serbia. Serbia. That's where it was from. And it has, like, it's, like, White Oak Pastures, blah, 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 like another two words of bullshit. And it's a complete clone of the White Oak Pastures website, and they even take PayPal. So, hey, you know what? If it's a lie, you'll just get your money back. No, you won't, because what they're going to do is they're going to close down the account or just move all the money out of it and orphan it is what's going to happen. So it wasn't the real site. This was on a reel on Facebook that was a paid advertisement that Meta took money for and knowingly allowed to be advertised. So, I don't want to hear anybody's bullshit about you're going to get ripped off if you buy something on the dark web when the largest social media company in the world is taking advertiser money on a daily basis, because I have seen hundreds of examples of this. You can buy, you know, 8 pairs of these super cargo pants for $36. I'll tell you what happens when you order them. You give them $36 and then nothing happens. They're never coming. I see ad after ad after ad after ad. We have real Rolexes for $19.95. No, you don't. You're not even selling a fake Rolex for that. And Facebook takes the money and sticks it right in front of millions and millions of people, but don't go to the dark web because that's where trouble comes from. This is all nonsense. This is all bullshit. There is no dark web. There is uncensorable technology, and when you use it, other people who you don't like may use it for things you don't like, and you need to be aware of that. And when you use the censorable technology, other people you don't like will use it for things that they shouldn't use it for that you don't like either, and you also need to be aware of that. You're not going to go get your identity stolen because you use the Tor browser. In fact, it's a great way to not get your identity stolen. Soapbox in the closet. Done for the show until I get to my segment, I promise. Now let's talk about IRAs and using them for real estate in a specific situation here that Matt Sersley will handle.
Hey, TSP. Matthew Sersley here, the Agorist Tax Advisor, answering another question. The question we got is, can I move non-Roth IRA funds to a self-held IRA? I have the opportunity to purchase some pasture land adjacent to our farmstead. I would like to create a self-held IRA and hold the deed. Land has established non-family renters and price is reasonable. How do I go about creating a self-held IRA, how to transfer funds, and any pitfalls to this idea? Now, I'm pretty sure he's talking about a self-directed IRA. And this is a great question. I absolutely love self-directed IRAs because they're an incredibly powerful tool. Just like firearms are an incredibly powerful tool, however, you have to know the rules. You know, it can be a great thing for you, or you can blow off your own foot. Now, what is a self-directed IRA? It's an IRA just like any other IRA, except you can put in non-Wall Street assets. Officially, they're called alternative assets. So you can hold real estate, you can do private lending, you can hold crypto, you can hold gold, etc. This is one of the only ways to do crypto in an IRA before they were in ETFs. You can't put anything into them. There's a few things you can't, collectibles being the big one, and they can be traditional or Roth. What they're not. It's not a self-managed IRA like you trade on E-Trade or Fidelity. And you don't get to hold the deed. Any property held by the IRA is deeded to the property or the IRA custodian, not you. Now, moving funds to a self-directed IRA is incredibly simple. First, you open up an IRA with the custodian that allows you to hold real estate in this case. Not all custodians will allow you to do every asset. So you do need to talk with the custodian. You do a trustee to trustee transfer from one IRA to another. It's not a rollover from IRA to IRA, although it might be if you were doing from a 401k to an IRA. Then you need to have the IRA, not you, buy the land, and the title is held by the IRA. Now remember, you can't mingle personal and IRA assets, so you can't pony up some of the money for this and have the IRA buy the rest and co-own it. And there's other rules. Now, in general, I love self-directed IRAs once you have enough money in them. It doesn't make sense if it's $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000, because the fees, and there are fees for a self-directed IRA, make it not worth it. So again, as I mentioned earlier, you can trade, not only buy crypto, but you can actually trade crypto and not have to keep track of the capital gains or losses for each individual transaction. Do it in a Roth, and that's all completely tax-free once you take it out. Absolutely, if you are a crypto trader, this is, in my opinion, the best way to do it. Another great thing you can do with it is buy real estate in a tax-sheltered account. Now, if you have the money to buy it outside of the IRA, I usually prefer that because you lose some of the tax benefits that you would have holding it in your own name. But if you have the money there, it's still a great way to invest if the return is good enough. Finally, there can be massive upside on a self-directed IRA that's a Roth if you're betting the moonshot. So very famously, Peter Thiel of PayPal put something like $50,000 of PayPal stock into his self-directed Roth IRA. The current estimate is that he has $5 billion, billion with a B, in a Roth IRA, 100% tax-free once he's old enough to take it out. So the power of this is absolutely real. But there are rules. And the biggest thing to worry about for a self-directed IRA are prohibited transactions. And the prohibited transaction issue is why I don't like it in this case. So remember, this is pasture land next to your existing land with existing renters. So there's four major types of prohibited transactions. You can't personally benefit from the asset in any way. And you count as yourself, your spouse, your children, your parents, and their spouses. So you can't let them use it. You can't let them do anything on it. That includes you can't rent to any of them. You can't use any of your farm equipment not held by the IRA to do any work on it, nor can you personally manage it or do any work on it or any maintenance on it or repair a fence on it without triggering self-dealing issues. So in this case, when you are buying land that's physically touching your farmstead, technically, and this is the lawyer's answer, but technically, if a cow wandered onto their land and ate the grass, that is a prohibited transaction. If you have a prohibited transaction that takes place, the entire IRA must be liquidated and taxed as a full distribution. And if you're young enough, you also get the 10% penalty on top of that. And it's not just this property. If you have $500,000 in the IRA and $200,000 is in this property, the full $500,000 gets distributed. I've seen a real life case where someone bought a rental property through a self-directed IRA and they put it on Airbnb, and they had like 20 Airbnbs. Their kid booked it by accident, not knowing it was their parents' home. No one figured it out until after the rental took place and their kid left the review. That transaction was a prohibited transaction, and the entire multi-million dollar portfolio had to be liquidated, causing a huge tax problem. Now, in general, something like that would be very hard to find out. But again, going back to your case where the property is literally next door, it's just going to be so easy to cross a line accidentally. And again, like, it could be something as simple as they ask to borrow a tool and you lend it to them. Well, since you're their tenant, that could be self-dealing. So easy to cross the line on this one. I don't like it. The idea is totally legal. It's just riskier than I like to do. It's not worth it in my mind. Much better use of a self-directed IRA is investments far from home. where you're not going to accidentally cross a property line and break the rules. But also remember, somebody else has to do all the work. A common case of this going wrong is you have a rental property, but you do the clean out after a tenant moves out. Can't do that. Can't have your kid do it. It's got to be totally arm's length. So again, love self-directed IRAs, just don't like it for this particular use. Now, a lot of business owners are missing out on dozens and dozens of legal deductions, and they don't even know it. That means that they're overpaying the IRS right now. I put together a free guide with over 60 real examples of expenses you could potentially be writing off. Go grab it at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. That's A-G-O-R-I-S-T taxadvice.com/TSP. Check it out. Save some money.
Let me put it down to the redneck version, the short, non-lawyer version. One, if you want any benefit from the property, you're not going to get any benefit from the property other than making money off the property. You have to think of it like you own a corporation, and inside the corporation is another corporation, and that corporation owns real estate, and you won't benefit from it until that corporation is either partially or fully liquidated in the future. And the property, for all intents and purposes to you, does not exist. And his example of the Airbnb thing, I think, is a little bit of theater and like an IRS Al Capone thing, look what we can do. And exceedingly unlikely, but it is, by the letter of the law, that tight. Like, there is, if you look at a piece of property and think, I want to benefit from this piece of property beyond I want money in the end later from this property, then this is not for you. Number two, if you are holding real estate and making money by holding real estate and you are paying significant income tax on the money you make by holding real estate, you have a shitty accountant and you do not know what you're doing. And I'm surprised you're actually making money with real estate because there is no... there is no reason for you to be paying lots of money when you are earning money from real estate relative to the amount of money you're making, right? It's like people like, well, Donald Trump hardly pays any tax. He paid like $35 million in taxes. But I get what they mean, and that's because that's how real estate works. That's the whole point of real estate. The next would be, the only reason to do it would be if you have money stuck in there and you want to use the money. However, in the majority of situations, you can borrow against money in a Roth and then take the money that you borrowed, pay back your own money like you were servicing a lender, which is how you should buy real estate in the first place with leverage. Okay, so now you're paying yourself back instead of the bank back. You're using your Roth like a bank lender to you. You now hold the property outside. You get all of the tax advantages of that. Plus, if you want to go live in the place later on, you can. It would actually be difficult if you owned a property and thought, well, you know, when I retire, I'll do the distributioning and then I'll go live in that place. Like, I'll kick my tenants out and I'm going to go retire in Miami. It would require you essentially liquidating it by selling it and then buying it back. It's a mess. It doesn't make sense. It's a bad idea. Don't do it. Okay, moving on. Let's now hear about the first step to getting into shape when, you know, you're 50-ish and you ain't done jack shit for 20 years.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. So if you're in the Woodstock area, come see us. If you're not, I do have garage.fitness online, and you can follow some fitness stuff there. But the question I have for you today is, I'm going to summarize this one. It was a good one. It's something that I should be answering all the time. Actually, I do answer it all the time, but I should answer it to you guys more often or bring this up. It doesn't have to be hard. It's not always easy, and it doesn't have to be complicated. So here we go. The question is, I'm about to start my fitness journey. What would be the first things you would tell me to do in health and fitness? Background, I'm 50 years old, really haven't done much in the last 30 years, but I've been listening, and I think I should start doing something. What do I do to kick it off right? Okay, so the easy answer is this. Stop drinking sugar and move. That's it. What does that mean? I mean, stop drinking sugar and move. So sugar is in everything, and I don't mean just sugar, although I'd probably start with that. Most of the things have other types of sugars in it or other types of sweeteners, so maybe I should edit that wording to stop drinking sweeteners. So if you have to drink something sweet, that's a problem. I would rather you put a spoonful of honey in your mouth and get that rather than drinking Coke or Celsius or any of that stuff. So stop drinking sweet. It is nearly impossible to eat as much sugar or NutraSweet or DextraSlim or sucralose, all those things, in its raw form than it is to do once you super saturate some sort of drink like Coke or whatever. So stop drinking sweet. You can eat sweet, sure, that's fine. I don't really care. But stop drinking sweet. The next is going to be move. Again, I don't really care if you're not doing anything, then just move. Go out for a walk. I typically tell people to start with a mailbox challenge. If you live in a regular neighborhood, pick, I don't know, 10 mailboxes. Say, I'm going to walk 10 mailboxes. I'm going to turn around and come home. And then make a note. How did I feel? What did it feel like? If it was okay, do 11 mailboxes the next day. Don't push it too much, but have constant progress and give yourself feedback so you understand where you were and what's happening inside your body. You will probably find there's a certain number of mailboxes that was okay, but the next day you're not too good. That's awesome. You want to taper it back just a bit and get used to it. So I don't know, let's say you got up to 101 mailboxes. Okay, so bring it back to 90 and make sure you're okay the next day. Stop drinking sweet and start moving. There are other ways to do it. Really what I would do is ask or look at you and be like, what's your worst problem? So there are five pillars, how you eat, sleep, move, think, and connect. And I may start down one of those avenues. It may be sleep, right? I don't know. We'd have to ask some questions. If you are unsure and you want to start somewhere, ask a friend, ask a spouse. They're probably going to tell you, dog, your biggest problem is you're 300 pounds overweight. So, right, they're going to be able to tell you. If they're your friend, they want to help you. Another way you can do this is if you go to my website. It is crossfitgarage.com/free. I put all of our free resources that we come up with from these podcasts, whether it's on Jack's or my own, and it's on a website. So you can click through there. What I would go to is the 60 easy, and it's kind of playing off the idea of 75 hard. So the 60 easy, it's of those five pillars, 12 months, so 12 times 5 is 60, things you can do each of those months, right? So there are, under the eat category, there's listed out 12 different things. You could do, like Ken Daniels did, all of them and just do 60 easy all at one time, or you could just do one at a time. So what are we in, June, July, whatever? So you could go down there and say, hey, in June it says drink a glass of water before every meal to improve hydration and reduce overeating. I mean, that's really easy. And you're drinking water and you're stopping yourself from eating so much. Great. On the sleep side for June, stop consuming caffeine after 2 p.m. to improve your sleep onset. I mean, duh. Most of you probably do that already. Again, 60 easy. Move. Perform a daily squat hold for 30 seconds to improve flexibility. So you might have to look up what is a good squat hold. You're going to be with your hip crease below the top of your knees. But this is the stuff that helps you get going. I think Jack said it a couple episodes back, but the journey does not start with one step. It really starts with the second and third because now you're making progress. So that's what this idea is, the 60 easy. It is progress. It's things you could do that I know anybody could do it and you could step along the way. So I would do that. Stop drinking sweet and start moving somewhere. Guys, if you want more information on all this, you can go to my podcast, Fitness, Food, and Finance. You can listen to everything that you want. You can follow us online, or you can email me. I am happy to help. I do charge $1,000 an hour, or if you will log your food for 2 weeks and send it to me, we can review it, and I will help you for free. All right, guys, y'all take care.
Just to clarify the end there, I think what I actually said is when you take the first step, it's almost impossible not to take the second and then the third. And the example I gave is get up out of your chair right now, take one step forward, put your right foot down, and see if you don't feel compelled to move your left foot. So I agree with everything Andy said. I just wanted to kind of frame it that way a little bit for you as well. Next up, let's talk about foraging and the difference between wild carrot and poison hemlock. And then I'm going to come back with a little commentary, not so much on what Carrie is about to tell you here, more on this, what I see as an irrational fear, mostly by moms, people moms and doggy moms, because they found a poisonous plant on their property. And often these people own acreage. And I'm going to give you a startling statistic as to how many poisonous plants are around you, not just the ones you know about.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources, and I want to bring you guys a little bit of data on the differences between wild carrot, aka Queen Anne's lace, and poison hemlock. So this has kind of been seemingly in the public consciousness right now. Both are in flower right now, and both can look very similar until you take a closer look. Wild carrot is a very useful wild edible medicinal plant. Poison hemlock will make you have a very, very, very bad day. And I am normally not one of these people who gets overly worried about I don't encourage people to be fearful about foraging. In fact, it's often my goal to help empower people about it. But this is one where it's really important to know the difference. So I'm going to give you guys about three or four key differences to look at. And I'll get into a little bit about how poison hemlock can affect you and also the benefits of wild carrot. And if at the end of the day you are still not comfortable telling them apart, don't worry about it. We're not starving. We don't have to worry about wild carrot or Queen Anne's lace. We can just let those plants hang out until we're more comfortable with our identification skills. So, one easy thing to remember when we're referring to the harmless wild carrot, also known as Queen Anne's lace, is a little saying that people have: the queen has hairy legs. So while you get a chuckle out of that, that is a way of saying that the stem on the Queen Anne's lace is fuzzy, has these little fine white hairs on them, and that is always true of Queen Anne's lace. Whereas poison hemlock stem is always smooth. So there's one key difference that you can start looking for. Here's the next one. The stem of Queen Anne's lace is solid. So if you clip it off and you look at it, it is solid. If you clip off poison hemlock, it is clearly hollow. And it's kind of not like a little bit hollow. Like it's, if that stem is about the diameter of your finger or larger, it will be hollow. Another detail to look at is that Queen Anne's lace, like I said, it has the hairs and it's also green throughout. On poison hemlock, that stem, as the plant gets taller, so after it's, kind of depends, but after it's, you know, a few inches in height, when it's starting to kind of bolt and begin to create flowers, that stem has this reddish purple dappling or streaking, and that is another key detail to watch out for. So let's talk about the good of the Queen Anne's lace, and then we'll get into why poison hemlock is not to be messed around with. So on Queen Anne's lace, the root can be cooked. It's a little bit thin. It can be a little bit stringy. A lot of people will roast the roots and ground into a powder and used as a coffee substitute. Unfortunately, not a caffeine substitute, but kind of like dandelion root. If you want a roasted flavor in your drink, Queen Anne's lace or wild carrot can serve that purpose. The flower clusters can be fried, and they actually produce this kind of carrot-flavored little, I don't really know how to describe it, but kind of this crispy little carrot-flavored treat. The seed is also really aromatic, so when it's kind of gone through its whole flower and it's starting to set seed, that seed is really good in especially like a beef stew, or even I've used it in lamb stew actually. So those are some uses of Queen Anne's lace and wild carrot. One of the reasons I'm giving these distinctions is that if you are just looking at the flower clusters, those can be very, very similar. So I personally do not rely on the appearance of how the flowers are to really tell these plants apart. So here's the thing about poison hemlock, because they can most certainly occupy the same kind of landscape, the same zone, same kind of like wooded edges, creek banks, even roadsides, very common. So poison hemlock contains a neurotoxin. It seems to be most concentrated in the roots. And at this point, to give reference, I am looking at Samuel Thayer's Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants. And this is what he says about poison hemlock in terms of how it affects us. They are, forgive me here while I find exactly, the toxicity comes from conine, I might be mispronouncing this a little bit, and several related alkaloids which depress the central nervous system, causing respiratory paralysis, heartbeat suppression, and convulsions. All parts are poisonous, and numerous documented deaths are known. So I actually have a little bit of rather direct experience with this plant. Back in the EMS days, we responded to a call for a gentleman where it sounded like it was either a heart attack style symptoms or possibly even heat stroke. And we later realized that he had been weed eating this bank out by the roadside, and that sap that is in that stem had gotten enough onto his skin. You know, your skin can certainly absorb things. And basically he had, you know, with the action of the weed eater, had kind of whipped up this sap and gotten enough of it onto his body that he was having difficulty breathing and his blood pressure was not good. And he was having a real reaction to it. And I believe that he came out of it okay, but he was certainly in some trouble. So this is one of those things where you do need to be paying attention. So this time of year, you know, summertime, things are really flush. If you are getting into an area where you are clearing land, especially by hand, keep an eye out for this stuff, because it's real easy to be in with a whole lot of, you know, you're in there with, let's just say, a lot of wild elderberry and, you know, Johnson grass, and everything is tall and everything is thick. You may get into this stuff and not really realize it. So without being overly, you know, fear-inducing, this one's worth paying attention to. I keep an eye out on my property. I do not believe I have it on my property, but I have seen it on an easement that is adjacent to us. And so this is an area where the gas company comes through and they keep it mowed back. But I just kind of have it in the back of my mind. If I'm doing any work on that area of the property, I keep an eye out to make sure it has not seeded itself onto our property. So that's some of your things to look out for between Queen Anne's lace and poison hemlock. Don't get messed up by that stuff. It's a pretty rough thing if you really do. If Jack has the opportunity to run this segment before July 12th, that's when our next foraging class out here on the farm is going to be. That's in West Knox County in Tennessee. Give me a shout at strongrootsresources@gmail.com if you're in the area and would like to come out to our foraging on the farm class. And we will talk to you guys next time.
So look, I agree with everything Carrie said. I don't have a single thing to change about it, including things like large amounts of something toxic can be problematic even if you don't eat it. The weed eating example he gave, people that burn poison ivy, that never works out well, etc. I want to more address the, and again, it's been mostly mommies, okay, and I understand the mommy concern for kids and what have you. Mostly on social media, which is where I'm sure the genesis of this came from for his segment today, with this like almost overwhelming fear because I found something that could be toxic on my property. The most conservative estimate that I can give you of how many plant species exist in the United States alone that would be highly toxic, meaning it could either kill you or lead to serious medical consequences, in the United States is about 600 species. About 600. Meaning, if I take a walk on a standard 1 acre property that is anything except manicured grass, I can probably show you a half a dozen or more. Okay? So I've seen things where like this is like eradication policy to get rid of anything. Like, let me read you a list. I compiled a list of the 20 most toxic, if ingested, plants in North America. Number one's not actually poison hemlock, but it is a hemlock. It's water hemlock. followed by Deadly Nightshade, followed by Castor Bean, followed by Oleander, followed by Poison Hemlock, Rosy Pea, Jimson Weed, Foxglove, Monk's Hood, White Snake Root, Autumn Crocus, Angel's Trumpet, Yew, the Dumb Cane, Chinaberry Tree, Rhododendron and Azaleas, Pokeweed, Mistletoe, English Ivy, and Peace Lily. I've got Chinaberry Tree on my property. Number 15th most toxic thing in the country to eat. I'm not concerned. For myself, my animals, anything, right? Now, if you're thinking, some of those things sounded familiar. 14 of them you can probably buy at Home Depot or Callaway's Nursery and are used as landscaping plants in America. They are Oleander, Rosary Pea, Jimson Weed, Foxglove, Monk's Hood, Autumn Crocus, Angel's Trumpet, Yew, Dumb Cane, Chinaberry Tree, Rhododendron and Azaleas, Mistletoe, English Ivy, and Peace Lily. So 14 of the 20 most toxic plants in our country are used as ornamentals, and, you know, one of them is the third, two of them are the third and fourth overall most toxic that you can find. Both of those are more toxic than poison hemlock at number five. That's castor bean and oleander. Castor bean is what you make ricin out of. What is my point in all this? My point is you're surrounded by toxic plants. And when we clue in on any individual plant and like make that like the thing to be afraid of, we're just missing the forest for the trees. We're missing the forest and the trees, dare I say. Now, where I worry about this with kids is, does it look like something that they are used to believing that they can safely eat or put in their mouth? Right? Because your rule with your kids needs to be, don't put things in your mouth if you don't know what they are. But there are some things that might look like a berry you can eat or something like that. And where for preppers and homesteaders and permaculturists this gets dangerous is we grow so much that they can eat. These purple berries are perfectly safe. These ones will make you sick, and these ones will make you die. That's where you have to focus. I don't think most of your kids are going to be, but there's other things to be aware of, like, you know, there's plants that can do serious burning of the skin. No one's going to eat them, but if you don't know about them. So it's good to make sure your kids are aware and that you're aware of what's around. But please don't overfear something that exists around you at all times. Like, there more of the plants around you than not would be toxic if they were consumed. It's just the way it works out. Now let's hear about selecting good ammo for your carry weapon from Mike Melito.
What is going on, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Here to answer your gun and gun-related content questions. On that note, I haven't gotten any questions the last couple weeks, so if you have any, send them. Anything from defensive handgun stuff to Western big game hunting. From competition shooting to defensive pistol tactics. Send them to Jack for the expert counsel. With that, Jack asked for content. So I thought it would be a good time to talk about carry ammo, carry handgun ammo. First of all, with the handgun. When I love handgun, I do more competition handgun shooting and handgun training than any other platform. And I love handgun. I love it mostly because it's challenging. It's a hard platform to master. It's also less effective. We don't carry handguns because they're as good as rifles, because they're as good as shotguns. Case in point, nobody sends their frontline infantry into battle with only handguns. So with that, we should try and get every advantage that we can. Since handguns, and I don't care if this is not a caliber warrior segment, like I don't care if you carry 380, 9, 45, they're all inherently limited and less effective than rifles and shotguns. So let's not handicap ourselves by using subpar ammo. So I'm going to go over some criteria. If you are going to trust your life to the platform that you're carrying and other people's lives, you need to be sure that your defensive ammo feeds out of your gun when fired by you. Not that it looked good when some influencer or gun tube glitterati was pushing it. Like, when you shoot it out of your gun, it cycles and fires out of your gun. Doesn't matter what platform it is. I don't care if it's a Glock or a 1911. I've seen both have feeding issues. And this is more so with hollow points and defensive ammunition. Even with Glocks. Some guns just don't like some ammo, and they can both be really premium guns and really premium ammo. They just may not play well together. So I'm going to hammer it again. Your defensive ammo needs to feed out of your gun reliably when fired by you. So test your ammo. The next thing I'm going to say is get a good street-proven load. There are plenty of loads out there that have good street cred that have been around a while. If you like the latest and greatest products, that's fine, but your carry ammo is probably not the time to be a beta tester in a gunfight. I'm not sponsored by anybody. I refuse sponsors on my show. There are a lot of really good defensive ammo lines that have been around a long time. Speer Gold Dot, Federal HST, Remington Golden Saber, Winchester Ranger. And that's not the only ones. Hornady, Critical Duty, Critical Defense. Those are good proven loads. Get a good proven load. Caveat here. A lot of these loads, the premium loads, were developed for full-size duty guns. I would encourage you to carry a full-size fighting handgun. I'm big on that. But if you don't, realize that the shorter your barrel gets, the more velocity you're going to lose, and hollow points are velocity driven. If you don't believe me, then take a hollow point out of your magazine and drop it on the table. It will not expand. It needs a certain threshold of velocity. So if you're carrying a compact, subcompact handgun, make sure that that ammo will expand out of your gun barrel length. Moving on. Point of aim, point of impact. Try and match, and there are companies that do this for you, where they'll have a good practice load and a good carry load that are matched to have the same kind of feed geometry. Going back to feeding in your gun, they will have similar point of aim, point of impact, or the same point of aim, point of impact. This is important and I think often overlooked. Don't be the guy that goes and just trains with Winchester White Box 115 grain, nothing wrong with that ammo, and then you load up your, 135 grain plus P and expect it to shoot the same point of aim, point of impact. That would be a mathematical anomaly. That ammo can be great, both those. Nothing wrong with Winchester White Box for range fodder. There's nothing wrong with that load for duty. But you have to hit what you're aiming at. So try and match your training ammo, especially if you're doing any kind of marksmanship drill. If you're just doing really quick draws at a few yards away, honestly, it probably won't make much difference. But when you're actually zeroing your gun or going for more accuracy drills, Mozambique drills, things like that, get a load that matches point of aim, point of impact, that shoots the same point of impact, again, when fired by you out of your gun. Yes, I know good defensive ammunition can be expensive. But think about the reason you're carrying the gun in the first place, if it's a defensive handgun. That's a weighty, serious matter. Now, don't get analysis paralysis, but make a good, wise, educated decision on your carry ammo. It's a big, important decision. With that, guys, don't forget to submit your questions to Jack for the expert counsel, myself or anybody else. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
I mean, the only thing that I'll add to that is, from a legal standpoint, I like if you're going to use a dedicated round that is for concealed carry gun that is designed to be highly effective and highly lethal. It, to me, makes a good sense to pick a brand with the word defense in the brand name. Because, like he said, the most important thing is, does it function in your weapon? And then the next most important thing would be, does it do its job well terminally? And they all do their job well terminally. Why would I even care about something like that? Like, you know, critical duty versus, you know, critical defense. Like, why would I say go to the defense one as a lawyer? Because you never know what situation you're going to end up with. You never know what idiotic politics making prosecutors going to get a hold of your case and being asked a question like, oh, you used the Eagle Talon Man Destroyer. Clearly you wanted to kill somebody. Isn't that correct, sir? And no matter how you answer that question, the damage by the question being asked has been done. No matter how sternfully and even successfully your attorney might object to the question being phrased that way, the jury can now not unhear it even when told not to consider it, right? That is a thing, and it's something we need to be aware of. Whereas if you have a round that is for defensive purposes and you're asked why you selected a round, you say because it was for defensive purposes and it was a defensive handgun. It's a very easy answer to give, and I'm not saying it would be the difference between a conviction and an acquittal. I'm saying that it has the potential to be a variable that you can control in advance by making a very simple decision that doesn't actually limit you in any way from the effectiveness of the round. There's a lot of things like that that I think people who keep weapons for defense should think about. What would it look like if the weapon you use as a primary defensive weapon was held up in a court of law to show people what you used in that defensive situation? Almost nothing that you would carry on your person, like a handgun, would really be at much risk from that. But some of the outfits that I've seen people have with their home defense shotgun, you know, you look like a wannabe mall ninja, and that may not be the best thing for you. I highly suggest that everybody in this audience who's never heard the episode I did years ago with Masad Ayoub on lethal force and its aftermath, look it up on the site and listen to it, because it is a masterclass in how to prevent things like that from happening. Let's move on. So my segment for today is about a Bitcoin topic, but it is also really about critical thinking. I want always to empower people with critical thinking. And before I pick on anybody, and I'm gonna today, but before I do, I want to do a caveat on it with the fact that the reason people don't think critically is we haven't been educated for critical thinking as a mass education protocol since the days of John D. Rockefeller realizing that there was this new industrial age coming and we needed workers for it, and people that are critical thinkers don't do well on assembly lines. And the entire educational system was altered by one man and a lot of cronies and a lot of people who went along to get money well over 100 years ago, and we've not changed it. So it is not surprising that people can't think critically. But I also kind of look at it like, you know, the guy that grows up with shitty parents when he's 30 years old with his own kids, how long do you use that as an excuse for why you're a shitty parent? When do you stand up, man up, and act like a real adult? When do you stand up, man up, and stop acting like an idiot that was programmed by a school system to move around when a bell tells you to and do whatever you're told without question, and then start actually asking some critical questions? So here's what I mean by that. So this was great news that came out yesterday, I think, or this morning. I saw it this morning. I think it actually came out yesterday, though. There was an announcement made by the director of Federal Housing that you now can include your crypto asset holdings, not just Bitcoin, which lenders will be able to pick and choose the risk they associate with how much you're holding of what. If you're holding a whole shit ton of retard coin, they probably, you know, are not going to let you actually declare that, but they could, right? How much do you have? And Bitcoin would be the big one here. Maybe Ethereum, but Bitcoin would be the one. Or, you know, stable coins, because they're one-to-one back. So that actually would probably be more preferred by a lender. If you were holding, for some reason, I don't know, a lot of coin like that, like say Tether or something like that. And before I continue on with this, I want to explain what this actually is saying, because some of the people I don't think read it and understand it, and yet they're tweaking out about it. In fact, let me show you an example of what I'm talking about. And special people that do not think, I want to say don't think critically, but don't think at all. And for those listening to this on audio, it's a meme. It's got Han Solo on one side, and he says, "I can buy a house with my Bitcoin." And the evil Emperor Palpatine says, "Yes, only if your Bitcoin is on Coinbase." First of all, there's nothing about Coinbase in this. And second of all, you're not buying a house with your Bitcoin, nor are you even posting it as collateral. So let me tell you what it is, and then we are going to break down why the reactionary outrage from special Bitcoiners, I mean, I pick on special libertarians, we have a lot of special Bitcoiners too that are saying, this is an FU to self-custody. Once you know what it is, it's hard to actually get to where these people are. So the way this works right now is when you go to get a loan, there's your credit worthiness, there's how much you want to borrow, there's the value of the property, and then your financial position. Like, are you broke? Because if you're broke, even if you have the income after your down payment, you're broke. We don't really see you having any reserve, and now you're a risk. Remember, these are 3% down federal-backed loans. The lender actually takes a pretty big risk here because the buyer is the average person, and I'll get to what default looks like for a lender in this segment as well. But when you go to get your loan, you fill out an application to borrow money. They just don't go, oh, you look nice and that house is worth what they say it is. Here's money. You have to prove these things. So, you know, what's your job? What's your employment history? What's your income? What's your credit score? All that's part of it. And then what's the house you want to buy? Where is it? What's its value? There has to be an appraisal. That has to be submitted. There has to be a home inspection that has to be submitted. And that's all to make sure the property is worth, you know, at least what we're lending against it. And if you're buying a property that's overpriced and undervalued, then they might ask you to come up with some more money so that their risk is only the loan value, not the total purchase price. Makes sense? That's the way it's always been. Then they get to the question of your financial health. How economically healthy are you? What is your net worth is another way of doing that. So you say, well, I have all this stuff over here in my retirement account. I've got $250,000 in ETFs and mutual funds and bonds and stuff. And they go, okay, yeah, that's good. They put that down because they can verify it. And then they say, well, what else you got? Oh, I've got like a brokerage account. It's not a retirement account. They like that even better, by the way, because they can get at it if they really choose to sue you. But no one ever really does that in a home default anyway. What they're looking for is your financial health, not collateral. There's no claim on it. But they get, oh, you got $180,000 in, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. And it could go up or down, but yeah, we know, we'll look at a mean value of that. And you say, well, I also have some cash. And they say, well, I got $25,000 in your bank or my bank. Let me see your bank statement. Oh, okay, that goes on the list. You got anything else? If you got your pretty good net worth now, but, you know, every little bit helps in getting the best terms of your loan, your best interest rate, and highest probability of approval. If you said to that person then, I have $58,000 in other cash, they'd say, great, let's put that on the sheet. Where is it? I keep it in a safe in my floor. Here's a picture of it. You can see a picture of it right here to prove I have it. And I had somebody come out and count it and audit it. This is a recognized auditing firm. And here's a certified letter from the auditing firm said that the money's really there. You know what they say? Get the fuck out of here with that. There is no loan, especially an FHA loan, where you're going to put that up as proof of your net worth. So what this says is if you want to include Bitcoin or any other crypto asset as part of your net worth, it has to be held on a verifiable exchange. That's what it says. In other words, it's treating your holdings of Bitcoin or any other asset like it the same as it would treat your claim to hold cash or your claim to hold a security. I have to be able to see a piece of paper that says you did it. So the immediate response of the special Bitcoin community, the special helmet-wearing, crayon-munching Bitcoiners is, well, I guess it's just an FU to self-custody then. They don't need that. You could just give them an address. Okay, this is a federal-backed loan, you morons. Remember when I tell you about computer code and like if you change one line of code, it affects all the other code? Sometimes you can do a little bit of code update, but a lot of times when you decide you want to make something do something, it's not just new lines of code. You have to alter the old lines of code. Okay, now imagine those old lines of code are in a bureaucracy, like the FHA, like the Federal Housing Administration, right? Okay, it's not easy to change these existing codes, laws, and formulas and requirements that they already have. So when you go to get a loan that's an FHA-backed loan, they have procedures for how they verify assets for your net worth. Okay? It's about verifying reserves, not seizing assets. Again, trust me, bro, does not work with a lender. well, you could just give them an address and put an inscription on it. And they don't understand that, and they're not going to for a long time. And it's still not the same. When you get a loan like this, I can tell some of these people never bought a house in their life, so they don't know. There's a giant packet that gets submitted, and all the T's must be crossed, all the I's must be dotted, all the periods must be in the right place. You have to be able to prove everything you're claiming, and since it's a federal-backed loan, it is a federal crime to lie about it. And it's also a federal crime if you are the handler of the loan to submit it and knowingly lie about it or have false information that, based on your policy, procedure, and position, you should have known. In other words, no one's assuming the liability of this weird Bitcoin thing that they barely have just gotten to the point of understanding. Okay? The next thing, though, is there's no loss in custody here. Yes, people like me preach self-custody all the time. But there's nothing that prevents you from applying for the loan, declaring the crypto assets because you need them for whatever, because that's, and the real thing is here, this helps Bitcoiners because there's so many Bitcoiners, especially young Bitcoiners, the majority of their wealth is in Bitcoin, and they don't want to convert it into something else, pay capital gains tax on it, and give up ownership of the Bitcoin. They want to keep it. You see how simple that is? So let's say that you went to get a loan, and the loan officer looks at it and goes, you're going to have to help me out here. You don't have a high enough net worth. And let's say you have a lot of Bitcoin. You've got like 800 grand in Bitcoin. And you say to the guy, well, how much reserve capital would I need where I'd get a check mark, a yes? And the guy goes, if you had about 120,000 more to your net worth, then we would approve the loan. Give me a couple days. So you go to your whatever brokerage you keep your crypto on, and hopefully it's one that you're actually like, you know, you trust it, or why are you using it in the first place? You move a little bit more than they say you need just to cover your bases onto a crypto exchange. There's no consequences tax-wise to doing this. You haven't transferred ownership. You haven't liquidated. You haven't done anything. I heard a special person yesterday tell me every time you move it to a new wallet, you have to pay taxes. No, you don't. You are stupid, and so is your accountant, okay? You don't know anything. That's not how that works. So you move it into the exchange. You submit the paperwork that says you have it in your name, all your KYC and everything else, because it's a loan from a bank, you dumbasses, okay? And backed by a federal agency. They're going to require all that. They're not going to take Trust Me Bro or an inscription or whatever the fuck else you come up with. That's not how any of this works. You then get your loan. There is nothing that says you have to leave your crypto or your Bitcoin. I mean, I do Bitcoin only, right? There's nothing that says you have to leave the Bitcoin on the exchange. You can immediately withdraw it back into self-custody after the loan's executed. It's only for the purpose of validating the loan. I can hear it now. Oh, Jack, it's going to be a slippery slope. Then they're going to tag your Bitcoin. They already know you have it. You're the one that needs the loan. You're the one declaring it. You're the one dipping into it in order to use it as proof of your net worth. You're the one that said you wanted to borrow money. Now, here is the coup de grace on this shit. I know you people by your handles on Noster and on X, particularly in this space. I know you. I've seen you. I've watched you. You follow me and I follow you. We've been doing this a long time. Some of us, like me, since 2013. A lot of you people freaking out, you haven't been here for more than a minute. I've seen you come in. You're plebs. You're newbies. You're weak, soft-ass hands. And you're also been sold on some sort of special dream that is not reality here. And you're the same people that when Jack Mahler a month ago said, we now have Bitcoin lending. It's, you know, 12% or 9% or whatever it is. You're like, woohoo, yay! God, you're stupid. God, you are stupid. What does Strike require of you to lend you money against your Bitcoin? You must hold it on Strike, and you cannot withdraw it during the term of the loan, or if you do not keep enough in your balance on Strike, your loan will get called. If your balance goes down in value because Bitcoin goes down, you either have to deposit more or get called out in your loan. See how that works? So Strike's program, River's program, etc., like this, these lending programs, in these exchanges that these people all cheered for actually lock up your Bitcoin as collateral. This new federal policy simply allows you to disclose it if you need it in order to get you your loan, and all of these assholes are acting like it's the new world order taking your Bitcoin away. Now, how hard was it for me to know that? Well, I went and verified everything, okay, after I already figured it out. It took me about 2 minutes to read the actual notice, see what it actually said, understand what taking a mortgage is, having done it a few times in my life, both as a buyer of a rental property and a personal property, which are handled totally different, both with conventional loans and government-backed loans, which are handled differently, okay? To go, this is what this is. It is only the declaration that you have it, and only if you need it to secure the mortgage. It's not collateral. It's not borrowing against it. And that's what most of these idiots think. They think that's why the meme said that. They think you're using your Bitcoin to buy a house. No, you're declaring your Bitcoin as an asset in order for a bureaucratically thick organization to accept that you have it. They need something in bureaucratic form that proves that you do legally, that matches up with all their other policies that they've had for 50 fucking years. Some of you people will never be happy. I would tell you to think critically, but I think you have to start out first with thinking at all. This is great news for Bitcoin. It's more acceptance into the mainstream, and that's the reason some of you special people are really twerked off about it. There's a huge portion of Bitcoiners, they want their cake and they want to eat it too. And I don't mean borrowing against Bitcoin for retirement like Michael Saylor talks about. What I mean is they want Bitcoin to only be for their special little world and their special little things, but they want it to be worth millions of dollars someday, and they want mainstream adoption without mainstream adoption. In the words of Goldmember, then there is no pleasing you. And there's no need for anybody to try. This is great news, and if you look at the way the reactionaries are behaving with it, this is a master course in critical thinking and proof that even among people who fancy themselves as doing the work and thinking critically, critical thinking is not common in the world today. With that, we have wrapped up another episode of the show. Thanks for tuning in today. Again, if you have not yet picked up a copy of Laws of Life, please do so. The fixed corrected version should be shipping, but I have not yet been able to confirm that. No one's emailed me and said I got one recently and it has been fixed, so I can't guarantee that you'll get a rectified copy of the version problem we had when we first submitted. I don't know why it's taking this long. I just ordered another copy yesterday, and when it comes in, I'll find out if they're finally shipping the copy as corrected, and I corrected it almost a month ago now. No matter what, this is a great book, especially for young people with their whole lives ahead of them. It's what I wish somebody would have told Jack Spirico when he was 20-something and had just moved to Texas, because even though everything worked out, I could have moved so much faster if I had had this guidance at that age. Thank you, guys, and I will catch you tomorrow with a flashback, and next week we'll do this all over again. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month.